It has been another jam-packed week here in Washington, with infrastructure appearing to be on the path to passing the Senate. The January 6th Select Committee kicking off their hearings with emotional testimony from police who defended the Capitol that day, and a new challenge facing President Biden as hospitalizations increase due to the Delta variant. Joining us to examine the political implications of a lot of this are Brooks and Dione, that is New York Times columnist David Brooks and E.J. Dione of The Washington Post. Jonathan Capehart is away. Very good to see you, E.J. Dione. Good to have you back with
us. Good to be here. Thanks.
So the topic's, though, pretty sober, David. Here we are. A lot of us thought we were on the way to a good place with this COVID-19, and we find out this variant is very tricky. Even people who are vaccinated can spread it, and a lot of breakthrough infections. Democrats, the president, practically begging people to get vaccinated, wear masks. Republicans are divided. You've got some of them saying get vaccinated, others not. How do you read what's going on, and where do we go?
Yeah, I mean, we were all looking forward to a smooth glide path, a fall of, you know, me and my bar scene, my clubs, and going to my Cardi B concerts and all the stuff I normally
do. Where you
do.
Hang out all the time.
Where I hang out all the time, but that's probably not going to happen. And so we've just got to deal with that. And the question is, will social fragmentation happen alongside that? Will the pressure of going back down into a more alarmed position tear us apart even further? And I think what's interesting to me is how geographically different it will be. In some places where vaccination rates are up in the 70 and 80%, you're going to feel very different than when you're in Mississippi. And in my view, we need to, as Marx would say, heighten the contradictions. That where we have to make sure that people understand where people are vaccinated, life is a lot better. And I think we've learned even over the last couple of weeks, even this week, where there've been an uptick in vaccinations, that if you make it mandatory for some workplaces, and if you make the incentive structure very clear, you have to get vaccinated, that a lot of the vaccine hesitant people will get vaccinated. And so it may be cruel to say, but I think we just have to make the incentives overwhelming to get vaccinated for the sake of the common good.
And EJ, it's not all about politics. We know some people just have a innate fear of getting a vaccination, apparently. But there is a political component to this, in that a lot of influential conservatives are saying, don't do this. It's not the threat that they say it is. Is this a moment when when things are going to get worse because of that?
You know, in an odd way, I'm a bit hopeful because the message is getting through, sadly, because of the deaths and the sickness. And people are starting to become very clear that if you are not vaccinated, you are in trouble. But it is profoundly political. The 20 states that have the highest vaccination rate, all those states voted for Joe Biden. You couldn't be more political. The Biden counties are way more vaccinated than the Trump counties are. And what gives me heart is the Republican Party has been divided into three. There's one part of the party that right from the start was saying vaccination, you got to do it. Mitch McConnell, who had polio, is very sensitive to the vaccination issue. Governors like Asa Hutchinson and Mike DeWine have been there from the beginning. Then you had the other group, the anti-group, where if liberals are for masks and vaccination, then masks and vaccination got to be bad things. And that's the profound dysfunction of our politics. Where I take a little hope is there's a middle group that was afraid of the second group, really didn't want to speak out. And they've started to say, you know, Steve Scalise, finally the Republican leader in the House, a Republican leader in the House, finally gets vaccinated. They're starting to say, you know, this is bad for our states and it's bad for our people. It's red counties and red states that are in the most trouble. And I'm sure a lot of business people who support Republicans are saying, this is not good. You got to get off this anti-vax stuff. So they've created space for companies and the National Football League, for example, to get much tougher and say, you know, you got to get vaccinated as with some compulsion. I don't think compulsion would have worked 2 months ago. I think it can work now because people realize we got to get out of this.
And by telling federal employees, David, the hope is that private businesses will tell employees as well.
Right, and you know, I know a lot of people who didn't, young people who didn't want to get vaccinated because they figured the odds of them getting really sick were small, and they didn't know the vaccine was rushed, and this was their logic. And then when a school tells them, if you want to go to school, you got to get vaccinated, they say, okay.
Yeah.
And so the practical demand overwhelms the natural hesitancy that especially some young people feel. And so I'm with EJ. I think in general, there's been a drift toward making this a little less of a culture war issue, at least for 80% of the country.
I do want to turn to something that I think we all had to be looking at this week, EJ, and that is the hearings, the January 6th Select Committee hearings, where we had a very powerful testimony from four Capitol, U.S. Capitol police officers who physically battled the rioters that day, and spoke very movingly about what it meant to them and why they were there to testify. And yet, again, you have Republicans who don't want to be part of that committee. There's still the anger over Speaker Pelosi about taking Republicans off the committee. Is that effort going to lead to something productive? What do you see right now?
I think that hearing all by itself made the case for this investigation because I think those officers not only moved the country, just it was a moving moment. And, you know, one Michael Fanone, one of the officers, saying that he felt like he went to hell and back. And he really had a pointed jab at the Republicans saying, you know, they're trying to say it wasn't hell. You know, and it was, and he was attacking the denials of January 6th. And, you know, Officer Dunn, who talked about having a word yelled at him that we'd never say on this show, and the overt racism of some of the people in that crowd. I think people learned things from this. And so I think a couple of things came out of it. One is the best hearings in Congress are not when people on the committee give long speeches. It's when they allow witnesses to tell the story and provide information. And I think these four officers, you know, gave a lesson to Congress going forward. The other is I think Nancy Pelosi made the right call in keeping off the committee people who were going to basically try to wreck the conversation. There were two Republicans there, Congresswoman Kitzinger and Congresswoman Cheney. They were great. They were clear. And I think this is going to be productive.
You still, though, do have, David, the Republican majority in the House, Kevin McCarthy and everyone around him, saying this is a travesty and starting to blame Speaker Pelosi herself for what happened on January 6th.
Yeah, which is 90% BS. But, you know, a couple things. The hearing showed that this was not just a bunch of tourists visiting the Capitol. This was a violent assault. and the violence of the assault was made clear by those testimonies. And that's powerful. I had a conversation with a military expert who said it looks like to him when you have a bunch of people coming into different entrances all at once, there must have been some coordination. And so I'd love to know what was their coordination and where was that coordination. That's important. But then on the Republican side, if I can get a little autobiographical, I came to Washington in 1985, the same year as a guy named Dinesh D'Souza, who was a conservative guy from Dartmouth, and I was from University of Chicago. And we used to go to brunch, and we were part of the same community of like conservative pundits and politicians. I saw a segment of Dinesh D'Souza on YouTube today, which was him showing bits of the testimony, really emotional testimony, and Dinesh D'Souza is laughing at them for being wimps and cowards. And so it was repulsive. And to think that, you know, I spent my career as part of like a community, and half of the community went off into the Never Trump world, which I did, and then the other half went completely bonkers, in my view. And so Dinesh D'Souza is part of that community, and Tucker, and all Carlson, all the people we grew up with. And so that's in my little world, but that's the Republican world, that people went off in radically different directions from where they were in the Reagan years, and that's part of our national life. And I wonder where the elected officials, where they're going to end up, because eventually you have to decide whether you're going to be with Dinesh D'Souza or you're going to be with reality. And so to me, this hearing was a little piece of that decision of where is the American right going to evolve.
And if I could just say quickly, I think one of the depressing things, particularly about Republicans in the House, is that the vast majority are either there on the Dinesh D'Souza side or afraid not to be there.
Right.
And that doesn't bode well for the Republican Party in the long run. And I think politically it's not going to be good either, because the 2022 elections are going to be decided in by turnout, yes, of the base, but in significant part by moderate people in the suburbs, many of whom swung to Biden. This Republican Party that doesn't want to take on the violence at the Capitol, those suburban voters are not going to warm to that in 2022.
But you do still have the former president out there, David, saying this committee is completely wrong-headed, right. Nothing happened. The divide could not be more deeper.
Right,
than
and
it is.
You know, I'd put the odds of him getting the Republican nomination are pretty good in 2024. Yeah. But as EJ was talking about with the masks, there are Republicans who are in the middle who are shifting away, and we'll talk about infrastructure. Republicans being reasonable, and so you're beginning to see within the party a sense that we just want to have normal politics again. And we don't want to be governed by this guy, but that's a recipe for political end of your career right now. And so they're feeling their way toward reasonableness.
And that's what I wanted to ask you about, because we do have what looks to be a deal on infrastructure, where you've got at least 10 Republicans who look like they're going to go with the Democrats on this bipartisan infrastructure plan. And the question is, what does this mean? I mean, we're in everything else, the divisions, you know, couldn't be starker. But on this, they are working together.
Yeah, well, as many as 17 voted for this thing. So, you know, there are two worlds. You read, frankly, a lot of the media whose their charge is to show the Republican Party are all completely awful and the Democratic Party are all completely socialist. And this is sort of the revenue model. You go to interview people like Rob Portman, the senator from Ohio, who's the leading Republican. He's still a normal, sane human being. Mitt Romney, Susan Collins, like these people are just normal human beings who want to do a good job. And so the reality, in my view, is not as polarized as sometimes the media portrayals. And that was evidence this week. And it's evidence that Joe Biden's theory that compromise can work is at least this seems right now in this week.
Only 30, 40 seconds left to sum it all up.
I worry this is a one-off, and I do think it shows that for a long period, they couldn't even pass a transportation bill because of the really strong anti-government sentiment in the Republican Party. During the pandemic, we learned you needed pretty strong government to keep the economy from going off the rails. I think there is a philosophical and ideological shift reflected in this deal, and it reminds me of the good old Whigs and internal improvements. I'm bowing to David's inner Whig here, where it's a much better term than infrastructure. Internal improvements are in the Republican Party's DNA, and they're finally coming back to it, at least for this one moment.
I'm taking away the image of the inner Whig in David Brooks.
Use an outer.
David Brooks, EJ Dionne, very good to have you. Thank you.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Thank you.